How do we decide? It's a big question, isn't it? How do we decide after my GCSE results what school or college to go to, what classes or exams or next qualifications to take? How do I decide that? How do I decide what university to go to or career to develop? How do I decide who to marry? I get asked that quite a lot as a pastor. Have been asked that twice, in fact, in the last couple of weeks. How do I decide who to marry? How do I decide if I should marry him or marry her? How do we decide about having children? And how do we decide about how to have children, the mechanism, adoption or biological or via fostering? How do I decide where to live? Just this morning I was asked that question by a young couple on the cusp of marriage. Do we live here near these parents or those parents or somewhere in between? Or do we go first for a job and wherever that job is then have that as a basis of our career? Or do we go via church, both settled in different churches in different areas? Do we pick one of those churches and then build our life around that? How do we decide where to live? How do we decide what church to go to? How do we decide? It's a big question. It's big business. You go around any bookshop or library and you'll see books touting various techniques or processes. And of course, corporate is a church. That question is big. I didn't manage to record tonight's sermon, but I want to re-record it because of where we are as a church right now at the start of autumn 2013. The autumn is always a big decision time, discerning things as a church, not least budgets, and budgets are driven by mission and vision and strategy. And what are we going to do as a church? What's God calling us to be in the next 12 or 24 months? And that's reflected, obviously, in a budget and how we spend our money. But added to that, we as a church are exploring what steps are the next steps to begin redeveloping our sand and road site, bricks and mortar and hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of money and resources. And how do we do that? We're now positioned this autumn to make some decisions on that. And an umbrella name, an overarching name that expresses something of our identity and values, that speaks of who we are and who we feel God has called us to be, but also gathers together the diverse units of our two buildings, our two businesses, our numerous congregations and gatherings and meetings of chaplaincy work, and brings it all together under one identity that speaks and communicates something of who we are as a community. How do we decide these things? Very relevant question for those of us who are Christians and for those of us who aren't. How do I make good decisions? How do I make decisions that I'm confident are right? Well, I want to look at the life, a particular episode out of the life of a man called Joshua. But I want to fill in quite a lot of the context, first of all, for interest, but also because context helps us with application. It's actually Joshua chapter 9 where we'll rest, but let me begin with that overview. The first hint to what Joshua is about is found in his name. Joshua, the name, actually means the Lord saves, or slightly more sophisticated, the Lord establishes, the Lord completes his promises. He saves in that sense. That's what the name Joshua means. It's actually the Hebrew, of which Jesus is the Greek. So all of Jesus' contemporaries at the time, his brothers, sisters, his disciples, would have called him Joshua. And it's only the Greek transliteration that comes into English by which we have Jesus. The Lord saves, the Lord establishes his promises. What does that mean in the context of Joshua's place in history? What promises is it that Joshua establishes? Well, it's the promise that God makes of a land, of a place from which God's people would be a blessing to others, to other nations. It's a promise we actually first see given to Adam, the very first man, Adam and Eve, in Genesis chapter 1 and 2, particularly Genesis 2:15. We're told that God made the world, and he made it so that Adam could care and care for it and keep it and cultivate it, be fruitful and multiply in it, be a blessing through it. That's the promise God makes when he makes the world perfectly in Genesis 1 and 2 to Adam. And we know in Genesis 3 what Adam and Eve, what humanity do with that promise of God. We corrupt it. It's true of us all, as it was of Adam and Eve. By nature and choice, we turn our back on that promise. And Genesis 3:11, chapters 3:11, really are the recording of that corruption escalating in humanity. And then God reiterates, remakes that promise to Abraham in Genesis 12. The promise is there again. I'm going to bless you with a land, a place from which you can be a blessing to others. In Genesis 12, 1-7, we read of that. And Canaan is the particular area identified, a geographical area identified from which God would be exalted and blessed by his people from that place into the world. And Genesis 12-50, the rest of the story of Genesis, is the story of Abraham's descendants as they're nomadic people wandering around, never settling in this promised land of Canaan, until we end with Joseph from about chapter 37 of Genesis onward, the great-great-great-great-grandson of Abraham, who ends up through a very convoluted process in Egypt, gathers Israel, his family, as it was then, into Egypt, where they initially prosper. And yet over four centuries, by the end of four centuries, they're no longer a prosperous component of Egypt, but an enslaved component. This is not the promised land. Egypt is not. They're slaves here. Their life is hard, and they're not a blessing as God intended. And then we have Moses. We're now moved into the second book of the Bible, Exodus. And again, God reiterates, in a sense, a promise to Moses. He says, no, I'm going to give you a land from which you can bless the nations. And Moses, his name means saviour. Interestingly, Abraham's name means father of the multitudes. Adam's names mean man, in the sense of the source of life, the first father. And Moses means the saviour. And he comes in and he rescues God's people out of their slavery in Egypt. But they don't get a new land. Under Moses, they're nomads again. They wander in the desert for 40 years. That's the story of Exodus, which is the historical account. And Leviticus, Numbers and Deuteronomy, they, if you like, are the stats and facts books attached to the historical account of Moses in the Exodus. And then Moses hands the mantle on to Joshua. Joshua takes over the leadership of this nomadic people, Israel. He inherits this promise that God has given. Joshua, remember his name means he establishes God's promise. Joshua is the one who then leads them into this land called Canaan, the land originally promised to Abraham 400 or 500 years earlier, the land which they would have and from which they would bless the nations. Now, if we carried on this historical overview past Joshua, we'd go all the way through the Old Testament, through people like the kings, like King David, King Solomon, through the judges, through all these other leaders who are trying to establish this promise, and each time it fails, as it ultimately does in the case of Joshua. We'd go through Ezra, Nehemiah, who tried to rebuild Jerusalem and rebuild the temple in the heart of Israel, the land that was used to be called Canaan. And we'd see that continually, God's promise is not ultimately established until we get to the true Joshua, the ultimate Joshua, Jesus. And he says, actually, it was never meant to be a geographical land, the place from which God will bless the nations, the place which will be called home for God's people, where God's people will belong and from which there'll be a rich source of blessing. That place is actually a person. It's the person Jesus. Now, if we finished our historical overview, that's where we'd land, and then we'd see the eternity of heaven as the ultimate place in which Jesus is blessing of his people and blessing through his people is experienced. But we're stopping before the end. We're stopping at Joshua. And so Joshua is given this role, as his name suggests, to establish, to complete God's promises, to save in that sense. And so it's Joshua who leads God's people, Israel, from being nomads to being a nation by conquering Canaan. Now, Canaan wasn't a nation as such. It was a region of the world in what we think of Israel, Palestine kind of area, which had a hodgepodge of clans and chieftains. They're called actually in Joshua cities and kings, so that conjures up things probably bigger than they really were in our contemporary minds. Clans and chieftains, think medieval England, were scattered hodgepodge round Canaan, anywhere between 6 and 20 miles apart, so very close really, living generally in harmony, united by treaties, sometimes clan wars breaking out. And Canaan literally means the lowlands. That's what the Hebrew word Canaan means, describes literally the topography of the area. It was a low-lying area, had a coast on one side, had mountain ranges on the other, and there was Canaan, the lowlands, with all these different clans, with their chieftains and their principal cities located hodgepodge all around it. And in Joshua chapters 1 to 8, we read of Israel invading this land, and they do it very strategically. Joshua is a military leader par excellence, and he comes in, and what he does, the cities that are named through Joshua 1 to 8 are the cities that are a band right through the middle of Canaan. And so Joshua comes in and he conquers the cities and splits Canaan in half, creates a fortified wall of cities right through the middle of Canaan, a kind of Hadrian's Wall or a Great Wall of China, this great defensive, offensive string of cities splitting the area of Canaan in half. And he does that because the principal way that these clans and chieftains seek to dispel Israel's attack is by unifying together, making alliances together and attacking Israel. And by splitting Canaan in half, Joshua has prevented them ever having sufficient numbers to do real damage to Israel, because they can't unify over this divide that he has formed. And so their armies are never going to be sufficient to overcome Israel's million plus force at this point. And then we read in chapter 10 that he moves south and conquers the southern cities. And then we read in chapter 11 he moves north and conquers the northern cities. You can see his military strategy carefully thought out here under God of how he's going to conquer this land. And then from chapter 12 of Joshua onwards, in essence, the majority of Canaan is now controlled by Israel. And Joshua divides up Canaan amongst the tribes of Israel, and different tribes of Israel manage, own, defend different sections, and they're bound to one another to defend it as a nation. So they're like a United States of America. It's the United States of Israel, the different tribes united together as one nation. It's worth noting that not every one of these chieftain clan areas was conquered by Israel. A number of them remained independent. A number of them managed to defend themselves, fight off the approaches of Israel. Most notably, that Jerusalem was one of these. Jerusalem was never originally an Israelite city. It was one of these clan cities, the major clan city of the area, in fact. And it managed to keep Israel out. It was besieged a number of times but never succumbed to Israel for 400 years after Joshua. So for 400 years, Jerusalem was a little clan enclave within Israel that wasn't Israelite. It was its own nation. And 400 years later, after Joshua, it was King David who claimed Jerusalem for Israel, and then made it very quickly the capital city because of its location and its stronghold. It made it the capital city of Israel. But by the time we get really to Joshua 9, that's where I want us to rest after all that context. By the time we get to Joshua 9, Canaan has been split by this fortified string of cities, but the north and the south has not yet been claimed. And really, Joshua 9 is a unique chapter. It's another chapter about another city, and many of the chapters are like that. They record the attacking and conquering of various of these clan cities like Jericho or Ai. And it does that. Joshua 9 is similar to the others like that. It's about this city called Gibeon and the clan called the Gibeonites. But it's different. It's unique. Because the Gibeonites don't fight like Jerusalem did, but neither are they conquered like Jericho. They stand apart because their approach is different. In Joshua 9, 1 to 2, we read of the normal, the usual approach, which is warfare. It says, when all the kings of the west of Jordan heard about these things, the kings in the hill country, the western foothills, and along the entire coast of the Mediterranean Sea as far as Lebanon, and there is a list of the various clans, they came together to wage war against Joshua and Israel. So there we have this unifying of forces to try and dispel Israel. But what do the Gibeonites do? Verse 3. However, when the people of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done in Jerusalem and Ai, they resorted to a ruse. They went as a delegation whose donkeys were loaded with worn out sandals and the sacks were old. And on it goes. They try and deceive Israel. Even though they're part of Canaan, they approach Israel in disguise as travellers from afar. In fact, travellers who perhaps have come hundreds of miles, well outside of Canaan. And they approach Israel in this sense, and we see Israel, Joshua and Israel's response in chapter 9, sentence 15. It says, "Then Joshua made a treaty of peace with them to let them live, and the leaders of Israel ratified it by an oath." So Israel are hoodwinked by the Gibeonites to believe that they're beyond Canaan. They're a nation distant from this land of Canaan, who have come to make a peace and probably a trade treaty with Israel. They're in essence saying, look, we know that over the next decade or so, you're going to claim this land of Canaan, united as one nation. You're going to become a significant international player. So let's make a treaty now. Let's gain a special relationship that will benefit everyone in peace and trade into the future. After all, we're a nation beyond these borders of Canaan. We're of no interest in your conquering. And Joshua and his leaders are hoodwinked by this. They're deceived by it. And yet very quickly, the deceit is revealed. Sentence 16, 3 days after they had made the treaty with the Gibeonites, the Israelites heard that they were neighbours living near to them. So they've made this major error of discernment. Their decision has been wrong. And they've made a treaty. And this error of discernment compromises their mission. It compromises the life, the mission, the purpose that God has called them to, the gaining of this land through which God will bless the nations. It's compromised them internally. Sentence 18, the second half, says the whole assembly grumbled against the leaders. This mistake of a decision has knocked the confidence of the people in the leadership, in Joshua and his leaders. And it compromises them externally. If we read on into chapter 10, the first half of chapter 10, through to around sentence 15 or so of chapter 10, we're told that this treaty between Israel, this strong invading force who have already claimed this fortified string of cities dividing Canaan, this treaty between Israel and Gibeon, which was a reasonably significant and powerful city, this treaty stimulates an active unifying of the other clan leaders and their forces. It stimulates that alliance, which then attacks Israel. And Israel comes under a severe attack in chapter 10. And God still achieves his purposes. That attack doesn't succeed, and Israel go on, as I say, in chapters 10 and 11 to claim the whole of Canaan, first the south, then the north. God still accomplishes his ultimate purpose, but without Israel's full involvement. In chapter 10, it's not Israel who actually ultimately win that battle. God includes them, but they're no longer the heart of what he is doing. And so this error in discernment, this wrong decision, actually compromises the mission that God has called them to be, their involvement, their part in God's mission. So you can see why this chapter is very useful for us. We think about, well, how do we decide individually, but also where we are as a church right now? How do we make good and wise decisions? And the turning point is in verse 14. That's where our attention needs to be riveted. It says, the Israelites sampled their provisions, but did not inquire of the Lord. See, notice their error in discernment is not because of the Gibeonites' cunning, sly, practiced plan. That's not what the cause of their error is. It's also not a failure to employ their human experience. We're told the Israelites sampled their provisions. The Israelites were experienced desert trekkers, and so they apply the human knowledge they have to this band who come to them. They say, well, actually, from our human experience, is what they are saying true? Is their claim backed up by their sandals and their animals and their food, and are they as worn out as they should be? They apply it. And so it's not a lack of using their human experience. And notice there's no criticism of that here at all. They're meant to use the human wisdom that God has built up within the community and the leadership. They're meant to apply it to the problem at hand, and they do. So it's not a failure there. No, the error in their discernment is due to a failure to inquire of the Lord. It says, but they did not inquire of the Lord. They inquired of the Gibeonites, where are you from? They listened to the Gibeonites, but they didn't inquire of the Lord. They didn't listen to God. 1 Samuel 16:7 tells us that man can look at the outward appearance, and that's a good thing. Human beings can discern the outward realities, which is normally a true reflection of the inward realities. But the Lord looks at the heart. And it's not always the case that the outward appearance resonates with the inward heart. It is often, but it's not always. In the case of 1 Samuel 16, it's talking about David, who outwardly looked nothing like a king should look, not compared to his elder brothers, who were stronger and wiser and more experienced. And yet the Lord could see his heart, and his heart was the heart of a king, the heart that was after the Lord, as we're told about David. And that's the error here, you see. They look at outward appearances, they use their human discernment, that's good, but they fail to inquire of the Lord. So as we return now to our question, well, how do I decide, applying it to our own personal life or applying it to our life as a corporate body, how do I know what God is calling me to do? How do I discern his will in a situation? We see these two things. We need to do what the Israelites, what Joshua did do. We need to sample their provisions. We need to apply our human experience, our life experience, to the situation. We need to use the skills, the education, the qualifications that we have to a situation. We need to seek advice and invite experts in who are better qualified than us to do things. In that sense, the church should be a professionally excellent organisation, whatever that might mean, ready to seek human wisdom into all sorts of situations. That's through pastorally. We might need medical or psychological advice to make a wise pastoral decision. It's true in terms of redevelopment, isn't it? We might need architects, builders, plumbers, outside advice, expertise that we don't have within our own community. Churches that have travelled this road before us, who can offer us guidance, wisdom from their own experience. It's true of this seeking and searching for a unifying umbrella name, isn't it? That we need to apply our human knowledge, our human experience. There would be outward appearances which are true to what's going on, and our human appearance will help us to do that. It's what the Bible calls wisdom, quite often. Good stewardship of the resources God has given us. It's taking who we are as a people, as individuals, as a community, and applying it to the situation. They did right. We need to do what the Israelites did do. But we also need to do what the Israelites did not do, which is to inquire of the Lord, to pray individually as a community, to invite some close friends who know your life and know your situation to pray into that individual decision you need to make. We need to read the Bible, search the scriptures, hear it taught, respond in obedience to both years and years and years of consistent exposition of the Bible, as well as respond to those moments where God in his divine wisdom and providence brings a particular sermon, word, passage, Bible reading to apply to that moment in a very sharp, right way. It's inquiring of the Lord, praying, Bible, it's seeking godly counsel. Sometimes godly counsel speaks in a way that is more than just an expert's opinion on a situation, but speaks into the heart of the matter. And we need to look back on our history, see the trajectory of our own lives and our life as a church, see what God has been doing over a number of years, decades, the institutional memory, if you like, of us as a church or you as a family. And look back on that history and see what God's work has been, his direction. And I say that because here in Joshua, numerous times in Deuteronomy, instructions are given. Instructions of how to conquer Canaan are given in Deuteronomy 7. Instructions of how to make treaties with nations outside Canaan, Deuteronomy 20, which is the instructions they follow when it comes to this deceit of the Gibeonites. Instructions of how to make good decisions. Instructions that they would go to the priests and the priests were to do a certain thing, and that's how you discern the mind of Christ. And they did not reflect on their history. And so when they came to this situation with the Gibeonites, they didn't do what God had told them to do historically to discern his will. And so we need to look back on our history. What is the vision that God has embedded within the life of the church? that we need to keep in step with, the shoulders we stand on. It's true in terms of the redevelopment, the umbrella name, even agreeing a budget for next year. We need to inquire of the Lord, because though the outward appearance, the sampling of their provisions, is normally right, there are times, such as here in Joshua 9, when the outward may not be right. The heart of the matter is different. It's that tension the Bible calls us to hold between wisdom and good stewardship and faith and risk-taking, denying ourselves, risking our lives, inquiring of the Lord and stepping out when necessary. It's why the church should both be professionally excellent and ready to absorb the advice of all sorts of outside agencies that can guide us. And the church needs to be deeply dependent on the Spirit of God that sees the heart in a way that even the greatest human expert could never see. And of course, we're going to have natural tendencies here. Some of us will have a natural tendency to sampling their provision to that human wisdom. And yet, if we lean too far that way, we become arrogant and self-confident, even as that does not seem to be our outward personality, but that's actually how we function. I'm confident in myself. That is the definition of self-confidence, isn't it? Confidence in people. And yet, if we lean the other way, we lean to inquiring of the Lord while not actually applying the human skills and being diligent with who God has made us, we become hyper-spiritual. In 1 Thessalonians 5, those sorts of people are called disruptive and idle. And that's the risk, isn't it? Our heads are so high in the clouds, we're of no earthly good. So we need to be balanced. Balanced as individuals, which is often where godly counsel comes in, bringing others alongside us. And balanced as a community, hearing the variety of voices and seeing which it is God is discerning us to follow. Some voices within our church community will lean towards sampling the provision. That's good and right. We need the expert's opinion, the architect's plans, the planning permission. Some of us will veer towards inquiring of the Lord. Faith, step out, take the risk. Both are true. Both are right. Both are needed. Both must be heard. And we must inquire of the Lord together.